This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Tabea Linhard about her book titled Unexpected Roots, Refugee Writers in Mexico, published by Stanford University Press, which chronicles the journeys of six writers whose lives were completely upended in the first half of the 20th century for various reasons that we'll get into, and ended up going on these journeys as refugees. They have a mix of different backgrounds, they have a mix of different kinds of writing, and yet there's some interesting threads that draw them together. So Tabea, thank you so much for being on the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very pleased to. Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure, as you mentioned, my name is Tabea Linhard. I'm a professor of Spanish Comparative Literature and Global Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. I've been at this institution for about 20 years. Before living here, I've lived in Germany, in Spain, in Mexico, in different parts of the United States. So I have lived my entire life kind of, you know, between languages, between countries, between cultures. And that, in many ways, explains why I decided to write this book. I had written two other books previously, and this one really started with two very different works that intrigued me and wanted me to learn more. The two works are a novella by the German writer Anna Segers. The German title is Der Ausflug der Toten Mädchen. It has recently been translated as The Dead Girl School Trip. And the other item is a map that an 11-year-old child drew in 1937 as his family was fleeing from Germany and ended up in Uruguay. Once I saw these two, you know, the novella and the map, I realized that there's a lot I did not know about how refugees, people displaced during in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War and during World War II, how they made it across the Atlantic and specifically to Latin America. So I decided that I wanted to learn more about these experiences. And this is how the book kind of came up.
Thank you for taking us through the development of the project. I think that's always an interesting way to start. And in fact, speaking of starts, the book itself, in a lot of ways, or at least talks about in the beginning, is picking up from the end of the film Casablanca. I found that a really interesting idea at the start of the book. Can you discuss the ways in which the book is doing that?
Absolutely. And so if I can speak a little bit more about Casablanca, as I write in the book, I saw that film for the first time in the 1980s, understanding very little of it, but I absolutely love the film. Ever since then, I've seen it over and over again and realizing little by little that this is, yes, a film about a great love story, but it's also a film about refugees during World War II, and it also is very much a film about colonialism. So if you recall, the film ends with the main character, Rick, played by Humphrey Bogart, and his friend, Louis Renault, strolling around the airport in the early morning in Casablanca. They talk about joining their resistance in Brazzaville, in Africa, joining Charles de Gaulle. And then we have the famous line, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, right? So the film kind of ends when some of the refugees leave North Africa, are about to make it across the Atlantic and then to the Americas. So I was kind of intrigued what happened during these trips across the Atlantic, and of course also what happens once these displaced individuals settle in the Americas. Again, specifically I was interested in Mexico, but really all of Latin America too. So this is kind of where the book ends. As I mentioned earlier on, Rick and Louis Renault talk about moving to joining the resistance in Brazzaville in Africa, which is also where one of the figures I read about in the book, Germaine Krull, ended up. She was a photographer. She also was forced out of Europe, crossed the Atlantic, and eventually makes it to Africa, where she becomes a photographer and cinematographer. So I think that moment, that end of Casablanca, is really where the story of displacement starts in many ways. I was also intrigued about this notion of a beautiful friendship. You mentioned earlier on that these characters, the writers that I discuss in my book, are all connected. And I would like to think of them as friends, but in a very complicated way. You know, friendships can be beautiful. Friendships can also be very, very flawed. Friendships can be all about hope, but all about sadness too, and loss. And I am hoping that this is what comes across in the book too.
I'd like to get into those complexities then, obviously by talking a bit about kind of the people at the center of the book. So you have six sort of main protagonists. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of who each of them are and also how you chose these to focus on?
Absolutely. So I already mentioned one of them, the German writer Anna Segers. As I mentioned, I lived in Germany the first part of my life. I did not really know a whole lot about Anna Segers, and my specialty really is Spanish and Latin American literature. And somewhat later in life, I realized that Anna Segers had spent a lot of time in Mexico because she was that's where she found asylum. And she wrote about Mexico. So after reading her novella, The Dead Girl School Trip, I became really intrigued in her story. She already was a somewhat famous writer before World War II. She was forced to flee, wanted to make it to the United States, was not allowed in, and then settled in Mexico, where she stayed until 1946. She ended up really loving Mexico in many ways. She kept on writing about Mexico even later in life, but those years were also hard ones for her. This is when she found out that her mother had disappeared in an extermination camp in Germany. She also was the victim of a hit and run, a traffic accident. So these were complicated years for her, but also very productive, even beautiful years too. Once she returned to Berlin, to what would become East Germany, she was suddenly in this bombed, gray, sad city, and she really felt a lot of nostalgia for Mexico. So Anna Segers then made me wonder a little bit more about writers from other parts of Europe who also ended up in Mexico, which then really led me back to my area of specialty, which is Spanish literature, which led me to the second author, Max Aub. Max Aub was not born in Spain. He was actually born in France. His parents were German and French. He settled in Spain in the early 20th century. And even though he very much felt Spanish in many ways, he always kind of felt out of place. Max Alb supported the government of the Spanish Republic, which means that at the end of the Spanish Civil War, he was forced to flee. He first went to France. He was in a prison camp in Algeria for a short while, and eventually he crossed the Atlantic, made it to Mexico, where he stayed for the rest of his life. In Mexico, Alb continued to be incredibly prolific. So he wrote fiction, he wrote drama, he wrote screenplays for television, he wrote poetry. He really wrote in every single genre. In spite of this productivity, Alb always felt kind of out of place, kind of abandoned. And he really wrote a lot about this pain of being from nowhere in particular. He returned to Spain in 1960, still during the Francoist dictatorship, and he felt completely out of Spain and out of place in that country he no longer recognized. So Max Alb, because he was so prolific, he was such an excellent writer, is fairly well known. But his work took me to a very different Spanish writer, Silvia Mistral, who also was not born in Spain. She was actually born in Cuba, where her parents worked in a sugar plantation. The family eventually settles back in Catalonia. Mistral is largely self-taught. And relatively early in life, she becomes a convinced anarchist, which also means that she needs to leave Spain at the end of the Spanish Civil War, again, crosses through France, and then she makes it to Mexico, where she also stays for the rest of her life. These are the Spanish writers. And then going back to the not German, but writers who wrote in German, this led me to four more. The first one being Egon Erwin Kisch. He was a Czech-born writer, also had to leave Nazi-occupied Germany, traveled across Europe, made it first to the United States and then to Mexico. And he continued writing about the place that he could visit. He really was a reporter, and at his heart, he wrote countless chronicles. And when he made it to Mexico, he continued writing chronicles about life in Mexico. He also was, and I think this is important, a very, very funny writer, but who certainly also disclosed kind of the tragedy of displacement. Like Segers, Kisch eventually returned to Europe at the end of the Second World War. He returned to his native Prague, and where he died shortly afterwards. Kisch, again, is a relatively well-known writer. The last two in my group of six are not. Let me first mention Ruth Rebald. Rebald was a German-Jewish writer and, of course, had to leave Nazi Germany, settled in France for a while. And out of my group of six, she actually never made it to Mexico. She had to go into hiding in France. Eventually, she was arrested and deported to Auschwitz, where she was put to death. Now, you may wonder why she is in the book if she never made it to Mexico. Well, the reason is that while she already was in exile in 1934, she published a book called The Boy from Mexico that takes place in Mexico, even though she had never been there. I happened upon this book by accident. I actually found it in the bookstore of the Jewish Museum in Berlin. And I was just really intrigued by this book from 1934. It turns out that the kind of Mexico Rebald portrays in her novel is very similar to the Mexico that the other authors would portray in their work. The difference being that they had made it to Mexico and she could never make it outside of Europe. Then the last writer also is an outlier in many ways, Gertrud Dube. She was born in Switzerland. She was not a novelist. She did not write fiction. She really was more of an activist. She also, like all of the others, had to leave, occupied Europe behind. She crossed the Atlantic. Differently from the other writers who wrote in German, Gertrud Duby did not return to Europe, even though she could have if she wanted to. Instead, she chose to remain in Mexico, and she settled in Chiapas in the south of Mexico and lived there for the rest of her life. These are six very different stories, but all of them had really complicated roots to Mexico, and what brings them together is this complex relationship with Mexico.
No, thank you for outlining them and highlighting those threads that bring them together. It is, in fact, the idea of the complicated paths out of Europe that I'd like to ask you about next. One of the similarities is that they were all complicated. Were there other similarities in their paths out of Europe? And what were some of the key things that kind of determined who had what sort of journey?
Yes, complicated they were, for sure. What really makes them different in many ways was, you know, whether they were, for example, you know, leaving from Spain or from occupied Germany. What also really mattered was what kind of connections they had. So I just brought up Ruth Rebert, for example, and I mentioned she was trying to hide with her young daughter in France. Eventually, she was arrested and taken to a concentration camp. Ruth Rebert was not a well-known writer like Anna Seghers, Max Albo, Egon Erwin Kisch, where she wrote genre fiction. She wrote for children. She did not have the kinds of connections that the others had. And this is one of the reasons why she could not get saved like some of these other individuals could. This is not to downplay any of their suffering. They all had, you know, very difficult experience. They shared traumatic losses. But I think that having someone like Rebert, who was not as well known as the others were, it means that if you had certain connections, if you had certain privileges even, that meant that potentially somebody was going to be interested in saving you because of who you were and what kind of works you had produced. And so that was not the case for Rebert. Some of the authors were Jewish, which also meant, of course, a number of additional obstacles. Some were not. Early on, I mentioned Gertrud Duby, who, as I said, ended up staying in Mexico. When she was still in Europe, she was taken to a prison camp, as Max Aub was too, as Anna Seghers' husband also was. Duby was in a prison camp in France for a short while, but Duby was a Swiss citizen. So Swiss neutrality kind of helped her along. She was able to get the kind of documents that made it possible for her to embark on a ship via Genoa. She made it to New York. And so even though I write about refugee writers in this book, it also is true that Duby technically was not a refugee, even though her experiences certainly share some of their traits with the others. Another big difference was whether they traveled by themselves or whether they had their family with them. Anna Seghers crossed half of Europe and then the Atlantic with her young children, and she constantly was fearing for their well-being too. Max Aub eventually was reunited with his wife and daughters in Mexico, but he took much of his trip alone. So the family certainly had a big role on them, as did gender also, of course.
Yeah, no, those things definitely have an impact. And especially, I mean, to me, the one that jumped out is kind of, if you're from neutral Switzerland, right, that makes a massive difference despite the fact. Yeah, of course, the borders are so close to each other. So that one in particular jumped out at me. And speaking of borders, in fact, I'd love to pick up on something you mentioned earlier, that one of the things that started you down this project was seeing a particular map. Can you talk a little bit about how you think about maps and how you use maps in this book?
Absolutely. So that map is the Freudenheim map. And right now I would like to acknowledge that I got the permission from his family to reproduce the map in my book, which is something that I greatly appreciate. So that map is done, as you mentioned, by an 11-year-old child displaced from Germany all the way to Montevideo, Uruguay. What struck me so much at the first time I saw that map was that I felt that here this child has succeeded in showing emotion on a map. And the way in which he did it, probably not even consciously, is that by drawing the map, he completely forgoes the use of scale, which is one of the conventions, of course, that we use to create maps, right? So if you have a chance to look at the map, you will see that the child drew in great detail his house in Berlin. You can see the window. You can see even the curtains on the window. You can see a red roof. And then you can see along the map how the family travels from Germany and to France. Eventually, you know, they cross the Iberian Peninsula and stop over in Casablanca, make it across the Atlantic, and then to Uruguay. So how can you show an entire ocean and a tree-lined street on the same map? The only way to do that if you just completely ignore the use of scale. But I think ignoring the use of scale is what makes it possible to show emotion, because that map brings up what is important, what is meaningful to the child. The house, the red roof, the tree-lined street in Montevideo, in Uruguay, those things matter. They have meaning for him. They are connected to emotions. I guess I forgot to mention that the title that he gave to the map is From the Old Home to the New Home. So this is all about finding a new home across half the world. Those places that are not really important for his journey are not really marked. So for example, the Iberian Peninsula is just a circle, and the only place that matters there is Lisbon. And Africa is tiny on the map, so it's not exact or accurate in any kind of way. But the place that for him was important was Casablanca, where the family, of course, stopped over as they were traveling on a ship. North America is completely absent on the map because it doesn't matter. What matters is that one street in Montevideo where the family found a new home. So as I was approaching this book, I really wanted to think about the ways in which maps could also show emotion. At the same time, I also felt that maps were important. Number one, because there were a number of locations that I was learning about because they were important for the characters and that I did not even know where they were. So I was drawn to maps and to finding these locations. They helped me understand further how complex these roads were, that they really were labyrinths. And as I was working on the book, I was convinced I wanted to include maps. And then this went through a whole number of different versions. I tried to learn to work with GIS, Geographic Information System, and I realized that the software was not helping me to produce the kind of maps I wanted to produce. So I ended up working with a local designer here in San Luis who drew the maps kind of inspired by the Freudenheim maps. And those are the six maps that are included in the book now.
Huh. What an amazing kind of process to go through. And thank you for talking us through the map and kind of all of its meanings. It, in many ways, gives us a kind of easy path to follow, I suppose, to investigate kind of, well, what was the journey like that's documented in this sort of map? Can you talk about the aspect of it that the experiences of fleeing Europe during these periods from these conflicts, as that map details, it's not kind of a straightforward, like today we might take a direct flight, right? Whereas right. Then it was a multi-stage process. You talk about in the book that this, quote, revealed the knotted history of colonialism and slavery at every step of the way. Can you tell us a bit about some of these things that the people were experiencing or noticing or sometimes not noticing on their journeys?
Right. So as the six writers, five really, because Rudolf could never leave Europe, leave the continent behind. You know, most of them stop through either North Africa, the Caribbean, and then make it to Mexico, right? And this is where they saw, you know, a world that had certain racial hierarchies that are the result of colonialism and the history of transatlantic slavery. If I can give you a particular example, Max Aup, who, as I mentioned earlier, fled to France after the end of the Spanish Civil War. There he is arrested and taken to several prison camps in France and eventually then deported to a prison camp in Algeria, which then was considered French territory. So here is this European writer finding himself in a prison camp where he also is guarded by Algerians, which is a very puzzling situation for them. Another example here would be the photographer Germaine Krull, who I also already mentioned. She ended up in Martinique, also in a prison camp in the Caribbean. Again, she was forced to leave occupied Europe behind, wants to make it to Brazil, eventually returns to Brazzaville, as I mentioned earlier. When she is in a prison camp in Martinique, Germaine Krull is not only appalled by the fact that she is in a prison camp, but there she is as a European prisoner guarded by Black Caribbean soldiers. And this situation is incredibly puzzling for her. And so this is the kind of world that they encounter and that they oftentimes do not question. I think to this we need to add the fact that, of course, they had to leave fascist occupied Europe behind because they were forced to flee from a world in which those who had certain imagined roots in a certain place would be the only ones who were considered to be the desired people to stay there. In other words, what displaced them from Europe is this notion that these fixed eternal roots exist. They go on their routes across the Atlantic to the Americas, but they also feel a certain nostalgia for this notion of roots, for a clear notion of identity or of who you are. And this is a constant, even when it comes to the depictions of Mexico, of the different writers. We oftentimes encounter certain cliches, certain commonplaces about Mexico that has nothing to do with the realities of the country. The writers often saw Mexico as a kind of a blank canvas, and they portrayed their ideals and their fantasies about the place oftentimes while they're already there. So they kind of saw what they wanted to see and not what the realities were.
Which is very interesting to think about, given the complexities of the journeys and, of course, the fact that they're writers, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Can you tell us about one specific way in which some people were able to get out of Germany, or at least for a particular, a small window, and kind of continuing this thread about how people experienced it and what they did and did not write down, what was the Martinique plan?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story that, again, I knew nothing about this when I started writing this book. So let me get back to Anna Segers again and her experience in many ways, kind of a through line for the entire book. Anna Segers was living in exile in France with her family when it turned out that the best way for her to get out of occupied Europe was to take a ship to Martinique. And let me mention that many of the refugees also escaped through Spain and then to Portugal. You know, as we see in Casablanca, Lisbon was the great embarkation point. But for somebody like Anna Segers or even Egon Erwin Kish, crossing through Spain was not a good idea. Both had been in Spain during the Civil War. They were certainly supporters of the Republic, and that could have gotten them into a lot of trouble with the Francoist government. But Segers was not the only, you know, anti-fascist or Jewish refugee in France. And at this point in time, after the occupation, that was a big problem for the Vichy government. So they came up with this idea that, you know, the best way to get these refugees who were considered undesirables out of Europe was to send them to Martinique, which was a French territory in the Caribbean. So this also means that a number of documents to make it from France to Martinique were not necessary because they were still in French territory. And so the contradiction here is that for the Vichy government, this was a way to get individuals out of France who they considered to be undesirable. They did not want them on French soil. For others who were supporting the refugees, among them the American Varian Fry, the head of the Emergency Rescue Committee, this became a really good avenue of escape. But it wasn't envisioned like that in the first place. The route did not last for very long, and not a large number of people were able to make it to the Americas via the Martinique route, but it ended up being incredibly meaningful in kind of the history of art and literature.
Well, let's talk about that. Why was it so meaningful for the history of art and literature?
So the ship that Seegers and her family took was called the Capitaine Paul Lemaire. Seegers was not the only artist who was on that same ship. Among them was the photographer Germain Crowe, who I also mentioned. Another passenger was the Cuban painter Bifredo Lam. Lam was born in Cuba. He had been living in Europe for a while. He actually was a disciple of Picasso. And of course, you know, Lam also gets in trouble once World War II breaks out, once France is occupied. So Bifredo Lam is in the same ship, as were Claude Lévi-Strauss and André Breton. Let me talk about Lam for a moment. So Lam, like many of the others, is taken to a prison camp outside Fort de France on Martinique at first, and he is confined there for a limited amount of time. Eventually, Lam makes it to his native Cuba, where then he would go on to paint one of his most famous paintings, The Jungle. The Jungle is an iconic painting in the history of Latin American art and literature, and the also Cuban writer Alejo Carpentier brings up that painting in the introduction to his book, The Kingdom of This World, and he writes about this painting, about kind of the quintessential Latin American work of art. He connects the painting to something that he calls Lo Real Maravilloso, the marvelous real. What Carpentier does not bring up is that painting probably was inspired not by the Cuban landscape, but by the landscape in Martinique. And Lam's stay in Martinique is, of course, connected to French colonialism in Martinique and to the politics of Vichy. Another individual who was on that same ship was the surrealist writer André Breton. Breton also had certain privileges. He was not sent to a prison camp like all the other passengers, but he also was, you know, under constant surveillance from the local government. He still has a chance to meet the Martinican poet Aimé Césaire, and André Breton kind of would never be the same after meeting Césaire. So that encounter is often discussed in terms of this is the moment when surrealism and negritude kind of come together on the Caribbean. There were other lesser known artists and writers on the ship, on the same ship too. I already brought up Germain Crowe. There were two German journalists too, Kurt Kirsten and Robert Breuer, who also wrote about that stay in Martinique. So again, it wasn't very long. Not many people were actually make it through that route, but it certainly left a mark in the history of art and literature.
Yeah, absolutely. That's quite a lot of people all ending up in the same place at the same time. And sort of in that vein, I wonder if we can move sort of to the end of the journey to Mexico. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was that like there, the German-speaking refugee communities? You talk about, in some senses, this creating, quote, a new chapter of world literature. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes, of course. So let me take us again to Anna Seghers. And she is the one who uses that expression in a pamphlet that she actually, well, in an essay she wrote for a pamphlet, she wrote shortly after arriving in Mexico. And the goal of that pamphlet was, you know, to gather money, to raise funds to support more refugees. So why is Anna Seghers, who only ever wrote in German, bringing up this new chapter of world literature? As I said earlier, Seghers was not really planning on finding asylum in Mexico. She wanted to make it to the United States. We can talk more about that later if we have time. Once she is in Mexico, she is, first of all, extremely grateful for everybody who has made her journey possible, to all of her friends on both sides of the Atlantic. And she's also very grateful, you know, to Mexican writers, Mexican artists. She's seeing this as a moment of optimism. Yes, she had been forced to leave Europe behind, but there is the sense that they're still fighting the battles, and they're fighting it with this new chapter of world literature. So it's a moment of optimism. At the same time, it also is a moment of isolation. As I said before, my book is about both the Spanish refugees and the German-speaking or German-writing refugees who found each other in Mexico at the same time, but they were not always well connected. Those who wrote in German had their own institutions, their own gathering spaces, and even their own publishing houses. And they continued writing in German, even though they were living, you know, across the world in Mexico now. So on the one hand, it's a lot about finding connections. At the same time, we also see a lot of isolation too. Seghers always said that one of the main reasons why she returned to Germany, not to this, you know, somber, dark East Germany, was because of the language, because she, you know, was a writer at heart who had always written in German. The fact that the Nazis had kind of appropriated the German language caused a lot of pain for her. So she was very connected to the language. She wanted to continue writing in the language in which she felt at home. So that new chapter of world literature was rather short-lived, because most of the writers went on to return to Germany. Some learned Spanish rather well, some didn't. Egon Erwin Kisch was apparently pretty good. His Spanish was pretty good. He had also spent time in Spain during the Civil War. We don't know a whole lot about Anna Seghers' Spanish. There is, to my knowledge, only one person with whom she corresponded in Spanish, and that was the Cuban designer Clara Porcet. Porcet also was a refugee in Mexico, and she and Seghers became very, very close friends, and they wrote to each other for many years, at first in Spanish, and then as the years go by, Seghers switches to French. So she kind of lost those connections to Mexico, to the language, precisely because that new chapter of world literature, as optimistic as it was, it also was rather short-lived.
But still interesting that it happened. I mean, the Martinique plan, for example, was fascinating, yeah. Even though it was such a small window. Yeah. Can we talk a bit about not necessarily what was happening literally within Mexico, but how Mexico was being thought about, both by the people who made it there, and of course you also mentioned that one of your six didn't.
Right.
How was Mexico being imagined? What were the tropes of this kind of fantasy Mexico? Was it different for the people who did actually make it there versus not? Why was this the site of some idea of a better world?
I think this idea of a Better World in many ways takes us back to the late 19th, early 20th century, and even to the childhood of many of these writers. So Kish, Rewald, and Duby, the three of them, in very different ways, write about reading the novels of the German writer Karl May as they were growing up. I, by the way, also read those same novels growing up in Germany, then in Spain, 1970s and 80s. So Karl May was a German writer who only left Germany late in life, but he wrote countless novels set in the Americas, mainly in the American Wild West. Some of his novels are set in the Middle East, and a few are in South America, and even fewer and more unknown texts are actually settled in Mexico. But Karl May's most famous novels are about an Apache Indian, Winnetou, and a German cowboy, Old Shatterhand, who was an alter ego of Karl May. So Karl May would, he had invented this persona stating that he had traveled to the West and to the Middle East, and he never did. Again, he did not leave Germany until it was much later in life for him. And he certainly never went to South America, never visited Mexico. And in the United States, he only traveled in New York. But the stories he invented about this Native American character, Winnetou, were fascinating. We certainly have the idea of the noble savage, where there is a lot about honor, friendship in those stories. And so these three writers, they arrive in Mexico looking for that kind of world, a world of adventure, a world of friendship, and yes, a world that was better than fascist-occupied Europe, a world that was burning, a world in ruins. Egon Erwin Kitsch was much more cynical about May, of course, and he wrote a few essays about Karl May once he was in Mexico. But the novel that Ruud Reewald wrote, The Boy from Mexico, brings up that kind of place, a place that is exotic, a place that is better than whatever you could find in Europe. Gertrude Duby, she oftentimes would write about being a young girl growing up in the Swiss Alps, fascinated and by the Karl May novels, playing to be Winnetou, playing to be Old Shatterhand, which, again, by the way, something I did as a child in the 1970s. So they come to Mexico with this idea in their mind. I mean, Reewald, she never made it to Mexico, but Duby and Kish certainly do. So there is a what we would call an essentialist perspective of indigenous communities in Mexico, based on Karl May's world. And even though, you know, really the kind of indigenous cultures you have in Mexico are very different than the ones you have in the American Wild West, but it is kind of ignored. Later in life, Duby would go back to that moment, remembering, yes, she once upon a time played to be one of a character in Karl May's books as a child. She then realized, as she actually moved to Chiapas, got to know indigenous cultures in Mexico, that she was really, really misguided about these fantasies about Mexico. So on the one hand, this is what they expect to encounter, what many of these writers also write about with great fascination is Mexican visual art, particularly Mexican muralism too. So the mural art by Diego Rivera and Orozco, they really feel moved by Mexican visual art. And I think this takes us again back to language, because again, they could not always communicate very well with the locals. And this is why they end up being so interested in visual culture, because for that, you know, you don't really need to speak the language too.
Yeah, that makes really a lot of sense. And it's interesting to kind of see how that practical issue plays out in terms of their thinking. I wonder if we zoom out from the individual writers and kind of put all the pieces we've been discussing together, What sorts of lessons might this book provide for us today?
Hopefully a few. So, first of all, when I was trying to understand how these six individuals made it from one country in Europe to another, then maybe to North Africa, the Caribbean, and eventually to the Americas, I realized I had to learn so many different histories, the histories of World War II, the histories of colonialism, both in North Africa and the Caribbean, the history of Mexico, of Latin America, even of Mexico's relationship with the United States. So I think if we want to understand or even try to understand displacement, we have to pay attention to these entangled histories too. If you think about the displaced today, many of them cross not one, but many different borders too. And I think we have to at least try to understand what is happening in all these different nations and how crossing one border may be very different from crossing a border in a different part of the continent. I think it also shows us that the rules about border crossing may change all the time. I mean, we can think about the rules and laws changed during COVID. If you go back further to the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War and World War II, the rules about the borders were reinvented constantly, and what was legal one day was not legal the next day. And I just use the word legal too, which is a fraught term when we think about displacement in the contemporary period. As you will recall, I said earlier on that some individuals, among them Anna Seghers, for example, or Egon Erbenkisch, were better connected than others. So they had support networks who could facilitate their escape from fascist occupied Europe. And not everybody had that. Now, what individuals like Varian Fry, who supported many refugees as they were escaping occupied France, they broke all kinds of rules. You know, they paid bribes, they forged signatures, they used fake documents, they made up the rules as they were along. They did many things that were not legal at all. But we would never think about these individuals as illegal immigrants. So I think it also helps us question what the term illegal actually means here. I think another lesson maybe is that these individuals were complicated, flawed people, just like all of us are. And they certainly endured horrible losses in their lives. They had to deal with enormous challenges. But I also do not want to put them on a pedestal. Sometimes they said things or wrote things that we could consider to be, you know, stereotypical, if not racist, with our current understanding. And we have to understand them as products of their time. But I also think we should see them in their full complexity as human beings. And I think if we want to understand forced displacement or migration in our contemporary period, I think we also have to consider each one of them as complex individuals, you know, who are flawed and who are flawed like all of us are. And I think I've always been kind of interested in putting on the paper a complexity of a life too. And the last point I would like to make, again, thinking about our contemporary world, is that the current system, the current legal system, which regulates the life of refugees and asylum seekers, emerges in the aftermath of World War II and in the early Cold War. So we can think about the Refugee Convention, for example. We can even think about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm not saying that the current system is perfect. It's actually, flawed. But it's the one that we have right now. And I think it's important to understand the origins of that system. And that is why I like going back to these complex lives in the 1930s and 1940s.
What a whole bunch of lessons, as you said, that can be taken from this. And I think the point about people being complex individuals is particularly well taken. And given that you said that that's something that kind of continues to be interesting to you to write about, do you have a next project you've got your eye on you'd like to preview?
Sure, talking about complex lives. So as I was finishing this book, I happened upon another story. And as I said earlier, this book really began because I happened upon Anna Segers' M novella and the Freudenheim map. So as I was finishing this book, I found out that a Spanish woman who also was an exile in Mexico, Margarita Nelken, she was living in Mexico at the same time as Anna Segers was there. Nelken was, for a number of reasons that we don't have time to get into right now, expelled from the Spanish Communist Party in exile in Mexico. And then apparently the FBI recruited her. And it looks like Nelken was tasked with surveillance of the German refugee community in Mexico. Nelken and Segers had met each other once, to my knowledge, before. They both were together at in Spain, in Valencia, in 1937, during a congress of anti-fascist writers. So something brought them together in 37. These two, you know, really brilliant women, I would certainly call them strong feminists, even though they may not like that term. Then they find each other again in Mexico a few years later, and suddenly Nelken apparently is involved in espionage for the FBI. I cannot say whether that's true or not. All I can say is that I have found evidence that that suggests that. Which then has taken me to a new project on women who were involved with espionage in kind of the same time period, so 1930s and 40s. And I realized that there were a number of historical figures, women who were accused of being spies, who usually were exiles, who were multilingual, who were rather prolific writers oftentimes, even though it's not certain whether they actually were spies or not. So my next book is about women, it's about espionage, and it's again about really complex life and less and about difficult choices that all of these historical figures had to make.
All right. Well, in many ways, very much building off of the book we've been discussing, a fascinating project. Thank you for the preview. And of course, while you work on it, listeners can read the book we've mostly been talking about, titled Unexpected Roots, Refugee Writers in Mexico, published by Stanford University Press. Tabea, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. Thank you for all your questions.